Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Hi, Mark DeLuzio, episode 77. This episode is going to be called The Illusion of Business Logic, and subtitle, We're Brilliant at Home, Illogical at Work. I want to talk about how do we live our lives. And, you know, for you lean professionals out there, when somebody doesn't understand what you're doing in business, it's always great to bring it back to how you live your personal life. Okay. How you do things at home. Because I can almost guarantee you most everybody lives their lives at home in a lot more adherence, if you will, to the lean principles than we do at work. And a lot of reasons for that is how we measure ourselves. When I invented lean accounting back in 1989, and by the way, we weren't sitting there saying, hey, I'm going to invent lean accounting. We just looked at, I was a cost accountant, and I looked at all the traditional measures that traditional cost accounting asked us to do. You know, and I was a cost accountant for Lego, the big toy company, global company, blasting products company for the mining industry. I was a cost accountant. I did cost accounting for a typewriter company, my first job out of college. And you guys are probably, you young guys are probably sitting there saying, what the heck is a typewriter? Okay. And a number of other places, right? But when I went to Japan in 1990 and I started learning 89-90, and I started working with the Japanese Shingajitsu at Jacob's Jake Break Division, I started learning that what we were measuring in your traditional cost accounting sense, like absorption accounting, purchase price variance, the whole standard cost variance analysis, actually created behaviors that were counter to the principles that we were trying to hold to, that were the new principles that we're trying to hold to, okay? So I want to walk through some concepts, some examples of how you as a lean professional could potentially go back and say, hey, wait a minute now, you wouldn't do that in your personal life. Why are you doing it here? And I found taking it out of the business environment and bring it back to personal, you know, everyday life, once we leave the company, it's a lot more effective to be able to get, you know, people to understand why you want to do what you do. Okay. So this is why I call it the illusion of business logic, because all of these measures that we instill upon ourselves seem totally logical until you take a step back and compare against the principles. Now, I'm going to have another episode on lean principles in terms of how you think about the principles whenever you're faced with a situation, because the principles are really the first thing you should consult before you even opine, or hopefully as a good lean sensei, you are looking to ask the next set of questions, not give the answer. Okay, so that's for another episode, but I'm gonna go through some examples. So let me start with this. The whole concept of how we measure ourselves for cost savings when we procure materials or products, you know, purchase price variance, and, you know, taking a look at how do you evaluate price with when you go grocery shopping. First of all, most purchasing professionals are measured to reduce cost against some standard. I almost called it an arbitrary standard, but let's just say it is arbitrary. The best way to get lower price, lower unit prices, is by volume discounts. So most companies offer volume discounts. So if you can get a really good price at, you know, at a volume of 10,000, but your company only needs 5,000. You just broke a couple concepts here. You broke the concept of just in time. You broke the concept of, you know, again, you bring in inventory when it's not needed. You risk spoilage, obsolescence. You've got the carrying cost. You have to have space to hold it and all the material handling that goes along with it and all the accounting and all the transaction. And probably the worst sin is that you're using the company's cash flow to buy something that you don't need, or at least you don't need today. So I just had this argument last week with a client. One of the guys says, well, you're going to use it anyway. Why don't you just buy a lot because you're getting a good price? So I turned to him and I said, well, let me ask you, would you do that when you go grocery shopping? Would you actually go and buy something, a year's supply? Okay. And he goes, well, probably not. I go, look, there might be an exception. Okay. There might be a good exception to do that, but they're rare. Those exceptions are rare. But we bring that mentality, we lose that mentality when we walk into the office or into the workplace. We just forget about it. We say, oh, my objective is to reduce cost, and I'm going to reduce cost by just spending a lot of money and getting a lot of volume in here that we don't need. Countless examples of that. By the way, another concept that this brings up is this whole concept of pushing versus pulling. You would not allow your grocery store to come to your home and deliver what they think you need based on your past history or your past purchases. You wouldn't do it. The way grocery stores work, you go to the grocery store, you go to the shelf, you pull stuff that you say you think you need, and you take it home with you. That's pull. And that's where Tashiono actually got the concept of a Kanban. Sometimes Kanbans are called supermarkets for that very reason. He learned it from Piggly Wiggly, a grocery store that's still in operation across the country. And Piggly Wiggly, by the way, you know, they didn't have those kind of grocery stores in Japan at the time. This is after World War II. So in Japan, you'd have to go up to the counter, tell the guy what you want. He'd go in the back room, put it all together, and bring it out to you. That's not how they worked over there at that time. So he got this idea of a pull system, but you would not allow your grocery store just to bring stuff to you without any signal. Now, I know there's online grocery shopping and all that, but you still go in and tell them what you want. You still create that pull signal to the grocery store to bring it in. So why are we taking product in one department and automatically delivering it to the next department without any pull signal whatsoever? I just went through this last week with a client, and they've got a plant that supplies materials to the producers and supplies materials to the next plant, to the next operation. And all they're worried about is uptime on the equipment. We got to, you know, get return on investment. So I, you know, my question was, okay, look, I'm going to take you out to your local bank and I want to see you deposit uptime or utilization or OEE or whatever number you're trying to, you know, optimize. I want to see how you bank that. I want to see how you do that. Because what was happening here is, you know, the company was producing inventory, not changing over, producing all A's when they needed B, C's, and D's, and just stocking up inventory and sucking up cash. Okay. That is a push system. And most of you that are in MRP scheduling, you may think it's a pull system. It is not. It's a push system. But we wouldn't do that in our daily lives. We would not accept that in our daily lives. But we do it at work. Okay. Because we're trying to optimize some number. Again, OEE, utilization, return on investment. I'd love to see you do that. You know, and I've told this story before. I'll tell it again. I was with a company down in Arkansas. It was a multi-billion dollar company, and it was a company that I was with the CEO of the company and the CFO. And I asked the question, how do you incentivize people here on the shop floor? And the CFO told me, everybody here gets measured on uptime of the equipment. And I just asked the question, well, why do you do that? And he said, well, we paid a lot of money for the equipment, so we got to get a return on investment. And I guess he skipped the class on sunk cost, which is a key accounting concept. Once you spend the money, it's gone. Okay. So I said to him, so you just bought a brand new car. You just told me you bought a Lexus. He goes, yeah. I go, those are expensive too, right? He goes, yeah. I said, so when you go home tonight, are you going to drive your car around the block, you know, a couple hundred times just to get utilization out of it? And he said to me, well, why would I do that? I don't know. I wouldn't do it, but you're doing it here. So why wouldn't you do it in your personal life? Why wouldn't you take that expensive car and get utilization out of it? Well, wear and tear and all that, and it's going to wear the, you know, the maintenance and all that. Okay, so those things don't apply here. And the real sin here is that you are creating inventory because you're discouraging changeovers, you're discouraging preventive maintenance, and you are losing customers because you're stealing capacity from part B, C, D, and E when you insist on only making A's because you're incentivizing these people to keep the equipment running. There's no incentive to change over. They're not getting harmed by that. But look at all this inventory you got over here. Why is it sitting there? You know, you see what I'm saying? You wouldn't do it at home. You wouldn't drive your car around the block 1,000 times at home. Okay. And by the way, when you go back to, you know, lean accounting, the absorption accounting concept does the same thing. It's like make more. The more I can make and capitalize into my balance sheet, the better my profits look. Well, those are phony profits. Those are accounting profits. What you got to look at is cash flow. You're taking cash, the company's cash, putting it into inventory. And if your weighted average cost of capital plus your carrying cost of inventory is, let's say, 20%, which is not an unheard of number, your bottom line is being impacted. For every $1 million of inventory, there's $200,000 hitting the bottom line. And that's real numbers. Those are not fake numbers. Okay. So it's about cash flow. It's not about accounting profits. Because eventually that cost that you put into inventory to get your favorable absorption credit is going to have to come out sooner or later. It's going to have to come out as cost of sales, probably at a discounted sales price because you had too much of it. You got to fire sale it. Or it's going to come out as obsolescence. Or it could get stolen, or it could get damaged. Okay, so the same exact thing here, okay? It was interesting. We had a client, I was working on a client, and they were making a thermoform type of thing, you know, the kind of film that goes into, if you buy a box of candy, and the little thermoform trays that are in there to hold all the different chocolates, they were making those type of trays. It's all thermoforming equipment. And there were 12 part numbers that were made on this particular machine. So in 3 days, we got the changeover time down by 83%. And when I loaded that into my model, I showed them that you could make every part every 1.2 days. We have a mathematical model to show how lead time and inventory gets reduced one for one when you reduce changeover time. So we were in a conference room and they were doing the final presentation. And one of the people asked, I don't understand why we got to change over every day. Why do we have to make these parts every day? And I said, well, look, your customers don't order. Because what they were doing is they were making all part A in week one, changing over on Saturday, which took like, you know, 7 or 8 hours. Then next week, they would make all part B, change over on Saturday, then make all part C the following week, and so forth. It's going on and on. So with 12 part numbers, you know, if you ordered the 12th, whatever the 12th letter in the alphabet is, if you ordered that 12th part number, you had to wait 12 weeks. Their average lead time was 6 or 7 weeks to anybody. Because of this production. And by the way, they did not size the production either. They maxed out and tried to make as much as possible for each week, regardless of demand. And the demands were different for each one of those part numbers. But what happened was they built all kinds of inventory. They returned inventory less than like 1.5 times a year, all right, because of these processes. And but they were getting their absorption accounting. They loved that. That was great. That, you know, phony numbers, fake accounting, fake profits, okay? So one of the supervisors, I don't understand why we do this. I said, well, look, your customers don't order this way. Give me a sales order. So he gave it to me and it had 8 of the 12 part numbers on it. Okay. This has one delivery date on it, one promise date to the customer, which I don't like promise, I like request, but that's what they were using. And I said, so they're not saying make all part A and just deliver that to me on one date. They're saying they want all 8 of these. And by the looks of it, you're going to probably have to wait 10 weeks lead time to get all 8 of these to the customer based on the way they were, laid out. He still didn't understand. I said, okay, look, have you ever had a barbecue in your backyard where you're cooking hot dogs and hamburgers? He says, yeah. Okay, let's just say you have 20 guests and you've got family, you got friends, relatives, whatever. Do you, when you're the cook, I said, do you only make the hamburgers first? Load the thing up with hamburgers. Then once you're done with that, you load it up with hot dogs. He says, well, no. Said, well, why not? Well, some people like hot dogs and some people like hamburgers. And, I want everybody to eat together. Oh, interesting. Okay. So you are trying to make every part every day in that respect. You're satisfying demand on your barbecue grill to serve both constituents. Well, isn't this order the same thing? Think about it. This order is the same thing. But what you're doing is you're making all the hamburgers first. Then you guys turn over and make all the hot dogs. And now I gotta wait for my hot dog because you decided to make hamburgers first. Again, I'm trying to make that analogy to the sales order, okay? And then you finally got it. We don't operate our lives like we run businesses. If you would just take these simple concepts that you don't even think about, I'm sure you guys don't even think about it. You intuitively go to the barbecue and just throw in hot dogs and hamburgers, knowing that you got demand for both. But when we get to work, we don't think that way. Okay? So that's how I try to bring changeover and the need to do more changeovers into reality in terms of, tying it back to people's personal lives. By the way, a crazy thing about SMED is single man exchange or die. Chihiro Nakao from Shingijutsu, one of my heroes, one of my personal mentors, said to us, how many hours do you spend a year in this plant doing changeover? And we gave him a number. Let's just say it was 10,000 hours. He said, good. I want you to still do 10,000 hours of changeover, but I want you to do 10 times as many changeovers in that time frame. Now, your typical finance guy will come back and say, we got to cut these $10,000 down. We got to make it 5,000. And I'll say, no, keep the 10,000 and do 10 times more changeovers. I guess that means we have to take our changeover down by 90%, right? Different way of thinking, okay? Now, how many times have you walked into a factory and you can actually skate on the floor because there's so much oil everywhere? I mean, I can't count how many times I've done that. And when I would complain about it, one time they told me I had the wrong kind of shoes on. Can you imagine that? Mark, you've got the wrong type of shoes on. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, let's take this to your personal life. You're driving down the highway in your automobile and your check oil light comes on. Do you ignore it? And why don't you ignore it? I know the answer to that question. You don't want your engine to burn out. It's the wear and tear on the engine. You don't have enough oil in your engine, your engine's going to wear out and eventually fail. But we don't have any problem in factories walking by equipment that are just spewing oil all over the place and not think twice about it. Not only does the oil cause a safety factor because of what I just described, it also is a hazard with, you know, particulates getting in the air, people breathing it in. And it impacts not only the wear and tear on the machine, it impacts, I can guarantee you, it impacts the quality of the part that you're producing. But we just go in, and what we do, how do we handle it? We put Speedy Dry and pigs around the equipment to maintain, to contain the oil. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So we don't treat our equipment like we treat our own automobile. You know, why not? Why not? Okay. So another example. So, you know, anybody gives you, you know, any kind of flack on leaky equipment, and you just got to understand this equipment's old. You got to understand, you know, if we went out to buy new equipment, and these are the arguments I've gotten in the past. We went out to buy new equipment. It would cost us an arm, you know, an arm and a leg, because, you know, so what we got to do is just patch up all the oil, all the oil leaks. And you just don't understand, Mark. You just don't get it. Okay. True story. I mean, true stories. I've been told that. Okay. And if we believe in the concept of safety, quality, delivery, and cost, fixing that oil leak is a no-brainer, because safety should be number one on everybody's list. Okay? Number one. What about visual management? Most companies I walk into, I have no clue what's going on. I have no clue as to the status of production, and it's even worse in the office. And I have no way to detect abnormalities, which is one of the key objectives of a good visual management system. Okay. So again, let's bring this back to real life, to everyday life. Let's go back to our automobile that was leaking oil. That oil light that came on that told you you had check engine, check oil, was a key indicator for you to act. It was like an andon. It was like hey, there's something wrong here. Okay. What about your dashboard? What about your temperature of your engine? There's a gauge there for that. Your RPMs, your kilometers per hour or miles per hour, whichever you decide to use. All of these things, and there's all kinds of other checks and balances. In my car, I've got tire gauge warnings. I've got sensor warnings. I got all kinds of things that tell me whether or not things are normal and are checked in control. Well, what about a game? What about like a basketball game? You get there 10 minutes late. What's the first thing you do besides find your seat and probably grab a beer, if you're me, is you look up at the score. Hey, what's the score? Oh, it's 5 minutes in. Oh, it's 12 to 6. Okay, now I know the score. Visual management. Go back to our car again. What if you're driving around the highway with no signs, no exit signs, no signs at all? How the heck are you going to know where to go? Well, you might argue, hey, my GPS will get me there. All right, well, good luck with that until you get lost. What about an airport? They decided to take all the gate numbers down and all the signs that point to baggage claim or, you know, terminal C versus terminal D. Where's the bus? Where's local transportation? Where's baggage claim? Where's this? What if they took all those signs away? But we don't create a visual environment in our companies to tell us even the most basic things. So again, another thing you lean people could do is use these outside examples. And I only named a few, and I'm sure you're probably thinking there's a lot more you could use to say, hey, why you don't do that in your daily life? And by the way, look at the examples, okay? Whether it's SMED or overproduction or pull versus push, utilization. Again, show me how you bank that into go let's go down to the bank tomorrow and I want to see how you fill out the deposit ticket to deposit, you know, return on investment or utilization or whatever crazy number you think is important to you. It's nuts. It's nuts. And we and the people, it's not a criticism, okay? Because I look, first 6 or 7 years of my career, I was, you know, fostering these type of measures, not even thinking until I started learning lean and starting to see things through a different set of glasses. I did exactly the same thing, okay? And you just walk in and expect, oh, somebody smarter than me must have set this system up. So I'm not going to challenge it. I don't even think about challenging it. And it, truly, when I really started internalizing the lessons I was learning in Japan with Shinkajitsu, you know, at Toyota and in our factories here back in the U.S., I started realizing that, boy, all this was wrong, okay? This is all wrong. And you start taking that to your everyday life, okay? And you start looking at your own life and saying, hey, there's improvements I could make right in my own office right now if I really was true to 100% of the lean principles that I know and love. Everybody can make those improvements with how you organize your garage, okay? Remember my wife and I were just talking about this. We're just had our garage painted and we're actually doing some work in there. Where do we want to hang our tools, like rakes and shovels and things like that? I don't need them right at my fingertips because, you know, I might use them so infrequently. They could be on the far side of the garage on, you know, inconvenient place to go because I don't use them. But the things we use all the time, yeah, it's going to be right at our fingertips. You don't see that in business quite often. Okay, so all I'm trying to do is take a look at your daily life. Think about how you run your life. And then bring those concepts back into the business. Now, I know that if your boss, for example, says, no, utilization out of that plant is really key and we got to drive that. Well, then you're not going to be able to, you know, convince your superior that you need to change over more often and match my production schedule to the demand schedule as close as I can. You won't be able to do it. And this is where leaders have to really understand these principles and learn how to adapt to them. This is one of the reasons why lean fails, because we don't want to change these, you know, what we might call conventional wisdom, which isn't that at all. It's fake wisdom. Okay? So think about that. I'll end here, but it would be interesting if you could email me some more examples that you've encountered in your business, right? mark@lean911.com will come up at the end of the show. Get my email and send me some examples. I'd love to hear from you. And how do you run your life differently than you do when you walk into the business? Okay. The illusion of business logic. We're brilliant at home, illogical at work. Let me know your thoughts. mark@lean911.com. And we'll see you next time. Stay lean. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.